This story starts in Malawi, in sub-Saharan Africa. A small town called Nathenje. Dark red mud brick houses with tin roofs, hens scratching in the dust, goats in the acacia trees, everyone moving at a pace appropriate to nearly 40 degrees of heat. Or perhaps it really starts in Dublin when I met a woman from Malawi called Faith, who was homeless. She had been granted asylum in Ireland but was having a problem getting landlords to rent to her, and for a while she had no choice but to live in a tent. She hadn't told any of this to her family back in Nathenje. They were given a much more positive picture so that they wouldn't worry. And now her sisters wanted to follow in Faith's footsteps to Ireland. Only Faith didn't want them to.
There is more jobs out there, but for me to get that job again, it's hard. It's a challenge.
I was in Malawi making a documentary, and I went to Nathenje to see why Faith's sisters wanted to leave.
So it's hard. It's hard. We're leaving, but...
What I found wasn't the good life that Faith described leaving behind over 10 years ago.
On a good day, how much will you get?
Maybe 4,000, maybe 5.
5,000 is 50 cents.
Maybe 10,000 a day will do.
Okay. A few of life's hard knocks meant that Anna and all of her sisters had to leave school because they couldn't afford the fees any longer. They were now hustling for occasional jobs and subsistence farming, cultivating a small quarter-acre patch of maize.
And so how often do you have to go to the fields?
Almost every day. So long I have a chance, I'm free, I have to go.
Okay. And are you doing irrigation in the field?
Right now, no, we're not. No, we lay on the rains.
But that is obviously very risky.
Between bad weather and theft, the maize was only lasting a few months of the year.
We can be there, of course. Sometimes we found that maybe there are people who have stolen some of... It's a challenge,
again.
But we can do anything about it.
If bad weather and drought does not take your crop, somebody else might take it as well.
Yeah.
Faith thought that her family still lived in the big house of her childhood. That was gone now. Her sister Anna told me her mother and two sisters lived in one half of a two-roomed hut with her uncle and his family in the other room.
When it is bad, when there is a bad drought, how many months of the year does the maize last?
It doesn't last for long.
8 months, 9 months of the year?
That's very far. Maybe first four.
Not surprisingly, Anna wants to migrate to Ireland in search of a better life. But unlike her sister, who has asylum, she knows that she would only be able to travel across the Mediterranean with people smugglers.
It's just a dream. I don't have any plan. It's my wish.
But you know that this is a really dangerous journey to Europe, that people are dying in those boats that sink all the time. Do you really want to take that risk?
Yes. Since life is hard here, it's the same as living where we're dead.
So I know, but you are alive here. You could lose really big by going on that journey.
Yeah, but I always stay positive, so I would still want to use my chance.
The World Bank has estimated that globally, climate change will push over 200 million from their homes by 2050. The United Nations says over a billion by the end of the century. I'm Philip Boucher-Hayes, and this is Hot Mess, Climate Migration. It's long past time to start talking about where we're all going to fit.
The different projections from different agencies and bodies around the number of climate refugees that we can expect by mid-century or end of century are so wildly divergent. Is there a figure that you find reliable?
Well, it's a great question. And there's a couple reasons why those projections of future climate refugees are so divergent.
Dr. Robert McLennan is a geographer and the author of Climate and Human Migration.
One is we don't actually have terribly good data about how many people right now today would actually fall under the umbrella of climate refugees. I mean, the term itself, refugee, implies somebody who flees their home country for reasons of violence or persecution. Obviously, the climate or the weather doesn't persecute people, but nonetheless, people are often forced from their homes because of extreme weather events, floods, storms, droughts, wildfires, and so on. We have a rough estimate, and on average, about 20 to 25 million people each year are forced from their homes by extreme weather events. But the number can vary considerably from one year to another. So that's our rough starting point. The question becomes, looking to the future, is what's the future going to look like? We have a couple important uncertainties. One is, are people actually going to do something about greenhouse gas emissions? Because if we do, if we get those under control and the future impacts of climate change are moderated, then obviously the projections will be on the low end of how many people are going to be displaced. So coming back to your first question, what do I think is realistic? Probably, quite frankly, by the 2050s, 2060s, if we continue on the path we're on, we're looking at hundreds of millions of people being displaced on a fairly regular basis by extreme weather events.
How many are temporarily displaced? How many are only internally displaced? How many end up leaving their home country?
The answer is it really depends on the country. So, for example, if we look at sort of the big source countries of weather-related displacements around the world, the United States is one of them, always in the top 10, often in the top five, because of storms along the Atlantic and the Gulf Coast, and because of wildfires in the Southwest. Most of those folks who are displaced end up being temporarily displaced. They don't leave the United States. They tend to move back to their home counties or cities after the event. And that's because there are resources to help them rebuild and recover. If we look at a place like, say, Bangladesh, where a lot of folks are displaced by floods, by cyclones and typhoons moving in off of the Bay of Bengal, a lot of those folks end up moving into the city. So they're going from rural areas to cities. And so they tend to still remain within their home countries. And when they do move internationally, they do tend to stay within the same geographical region. So folks from Nepal or Bangladesh might end up in India or vice versa. It's very rare that they end up being displaced by an extreme weather event and then hop on a plane and fly to Western Europe or Ireland or North America, typically because they don't have those kinds of resources, financial resources, to be able to do so.
I'm sure if she knew that you were going to get into one of those boats, she would say, "Don't do it, don't do it." But you're still going to do it, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah. It's also a lot of money that you need to put together.
If Anna were somehow to arrive here, despite the family's increasing difficulties feeding themselves in weather that is hostile to regular harvests, she would be regarded as an economic migrant. But is she not also a bit of a climate migrant?
How do we disentangle the term economic migrant or opportunistic migrant from climate refugee?
It's almost impossible, quite frankly. In some cases, it's obvious, right? If you're living in the Bahamas and a hurricane comes in and destroys your home entirely and you have to move, well, we can say, you know, the hurricane caused that. And if we look at some of the big migrations that we've seen over the years, even here in North America, again, going back to, say, the 1930s, the Great Depression era, where we had large numbers of people on the move from drought-stricken areas in the Great Plains of North America, they themselves would actually describe themselves as economic migrants when they got to their destinations, even though the fact is they were fleeing, you know, farms that were no longer productive because of drought.
I wonder if we change the historical context just a little bit more and say it's 1852, there hasn't been potato blight in Ireland in a couple of years, but I have expended all of my resources, all of my assets just staying alive during the famine period. And then I arrive in your country in Canada and you're an immigration official. How do you regard me? Do you look upon me as an economic migrant, or do you say, well, this is ultimately somebody who was forced from their home because of environmental circumstances? They're an environmental refugee.
We don't ask those questions now. We didn't ask those questions then. But your point comes to the heart of the matter, and it seems kind of funny for a Canadian to be sort of lecturing Irish listeners on their own history. But we've learned a lot from the experience of the Irish people in the 1800s and since then about what motivates people to migrate, who stays behind, who moves on to look for a future elsewhere. It's often a case that it is not the poorest of the poor. The poorest of the poor can't afford to leave. They don't have the resources to get out of the situation they're in. And those are the folks who lost their lives. The folks who left, they were the ones who could scrape together the passage fare to get on a boat and go overseas. Bringing that forward to today, we need to try and avoid those situations and make sure governments and households have the financial wherewithal to cope with these types of disasters.
Would creating a status of climate migrant make any difference?
The practical reality is that we already have a very clear definition of who is a refugee, and the international community does a very poor job of providing protection to those folks. And in fact, what we see increasingly is in the EU, the United States, and Australia and other countries that have historically received large numbers of asylum seekers, is that governments are trying to prevent people from exercising their universal human right to seek refuge from violence and saying, no, you cannot come here. So while yes, it would be great to have a definition that includes people fleeing climate disasters, the practicality is, are we actually going to use it to welcome folks, or are we going to use it as yet another tool to try and exclude them?
Thinking about is you guys, how you looking, how's everything going on with you?
After the break, Anna in Malawi gets a call from her sister, Faith, in Dublin. Telling her no matter how bad things are there, she should not join the migrant route to Europe.
You might sad.
Sisters Anna and Faith haven't been entirely honest. They've been sparing each other the full details of what's going on in their lives on different continents. Anna hasn't told Faith that the family has fallen on hard times in Nathenge, and Faith has been granted asylum in Ireland, but she hasn't told her family that she has been sleeping in a tent. But my presence in Malawi prompts them both to be a little less selective with the truth.
Are you not going to school anymore?
No, I stopped.
What happened?
We had no money for fees, so...
Okay, that's okay.
I've had to use an AI filter to make Faith's side of the call sound clearer.
How many do you live with there? How big is that house?
It's not that big. It's the one for Coco, her grandma, the late one.
And how many of you live there?
We are me, mom, uncle, and the wife and the kids. We're in Sydney.
I just don't know what to say at this point. I'm just speechless. I didn't know that things had got that bad. But they are not good here too. There's nothing I can say to make things better. There's nothing I can say to give you hope.
Yeah, you say it. Life is hard everywhere. Even here with the climate change and everything, things are getting harder and harder. We have no way to run to.
I just can't promise you nothing. I'm afraid to say something because I don't know it will happen or not. That is why I'm running out of words.
Running out of words?
Yeah. Right now we don't have even enough maize. The little we have.
I wasn't listening to the whole call, but I did hear Faith insist that Anna shouldn't try and travel to Europe. And I also heard that Anna wasn't really changing her mind.
There's nothing I can promise you guys.
There is nothing I can promise you guys that it will get better. There's nothing I can change and nothing in my control. So what do you think will happen? What is your plan? What are you thinking of doing?
We have no hope. We have no hope. We're just trying to maybe, I don't know. We have no hope. We don't know. We don't know.
Okay.
Can you give the phone to Philip? I just want to say something to him.
Philip.
If I had to guess, I would imagine that Anna won't end up travelling to Europe. As badly as she wants to leave, she will be one of the many who don't have the money to pay people smugglers or to buy a plane ticket.
For someone to migrate, they need to both aspire to migrate, which a lot of people don't want to do. In fact, I think most of the world doesn't want to do. And they need to have the capability to do so.
Kira Murphy, a senior policy officer at the Economic and Social Research Institute, has been one of the people looking at how many migrants climate change will or won't bring to Ireland.
They talk about chains of migration as well. So someone from a village might migrate to the nearest town and get some more economic resources and have enough then to migrate to the nearest city. And then by living in the city, they might then be able to get enough resources to migrate internationally.
But does that research say then that the vast, vast majority of people will always prefer to or choose to stay at home if at all possible?
Well, I mean, when you look at the number of people who migrate internationally, it is absolutely a minority pursuit. You know, you're talking about 3-4% of the global population, you know, over the last 100 years. And I mean, when you think about what migration internationally means, it's a very expensive and a very risky endeavor. You're talking about leaving everything you know, all your networks, all your economic kind of security, community, potentially the language that you speak, the culture that you know, to completely start again. It's a very, very risky endeavor for a lot of people.
What should we be planning for, though, as the globe gets warmer and warmer? Coming up with a credible estimate of the numbers that will come here has proven all but impossible.
When you think about what you're trying to count, it would actually be highly unusual if there was agreement about the numbers. You're talking about two extremely complicated things, both of which are very uncertain. So one is the climate, you know, how much climate change will there be, assumptions about how people adapt, how we change in response to it. And the other is migration. Even if you think about a single person or a single family, it's very difficult for us to assess quantitatively if a single person is going to move, because there are so many different things that come into that decision. And then you're talking about a human being making choices with their own agency and taking into account their personality and all their life circumstances and what they want and their subjective perceptions, which don't necessarily reflect the objective reality, for example. And then you scale that up to a huge scale and you're trying to, you know, assess how one really uncertain thing is going to impact on one another really, really uncertain thing.
But on balance, Kira, just because you can't come up with a precise number for how many are going to come, would it be naive of policymakers not to plan for an increase in numbers arriving?
Absolutely. I think that there is more or less consensus that this is going to be something that happens. I think in general, planning for migration is just crucial for planning for the future in this world. Anyway, you know, the global population is increasing, information flows are better, countries are developing, which is a key driver of migration as well, because people have more resources to actually migrate. In Ireland in particular, we have had very little migration historically. And the number one determinant of where people migrate is where there are already communities of those people. So as people establish communities in Ireland, we are likely to be more of a recipient of migration. And it's really important to plan for that, you know, to have the infrastructure for a larger population.
The Ukrainian war has seen the arrival of 112,000 Ukrainians into Ireland, which has placed housing system and the social welfare system under immense pressure. What does good adaptation to a coming climate migrant crisis look like in that respect?
In one sense, it looks like good social policy that should be enacted anyhow.
Dr. Robert McLemmon, author of Climate and Human Migration.
And so you mentioned the housing crisis, and we have the same thing here in Canada, is that we had a lot of immigration to Canada, hundreds of thousands of people in recent years, and there wasn't enough housing stock to accommodate them all. And it pushes up the price of rents. It pushes up the price of purchasing a new home for everybody. And so one of the priorities here in Canada is to build more housing, as I imagine it is in Ireland as well. We should be building more housing anyhow and updating our housing stock continually. That's just good public policy, whether or not there's going to be a migrant crisis in the future. Similarly, the healthcare system in Ireland, in Canada, we need to put greater investment in it, again, because we have aging populations and we have greater demands being placed upon it. We need to be doing that anyhow, regardless of how many additional folks might end up in our countries in coming years because of climate change. And again, the whole social benefits infrastructure and system that we've been taking for granted for many decades in both of our countries needs an overhaul, needs some updating. And so again, good policy for being prepared for climate risks, whether they're migration related or other risks, is really just good social and economic policy to begin with.
What did she say?
So she was asking of how we're surviving here and how hard life is with her there in Ireland.
Did she tell you?
Yeah, she did.
She told you that she has no home, no job.
Yeah.
She's very, very sad.
Yeah, she's very sad. And she said that we're not okay as well here. It's like both ways life is hard. Life is hard with her. Yeah.
She's not having the easiest time. No, not been easy for her at all.
Yeah, life is hard with her.
Bad for you here, but it's bad for her there as well.
Yeah.
Do you see why she doesn't want you to follow, to go to?
Yeah, because of how hard life is with her.
Yeah. Does it make you change your mind about traveling, or do you think you still want to travel?
Right now, I don't know. I'm confused.
Maybe it's important that you know how life is for her. It's not the soft life that you think that she has.
Yeah.
But then, maybe, has she forgotten what life is like here for you? She's gone a very long time now.
Yeah, she's gone a very long time, and she never knew that life is this way right now with us.
Mm.
At least by the time she was going there, but now it's waste, so she's very sad.
When she was still here, there was food all the time, was there?
Yeah, okay, not all the time, but at least life was a little bit better than now. Now life is not favorable.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that is because there is less food because of the droughts and all of the things that make growing the maize hard?
Yeah, climate change.
I think you have a lot to think about.
Yeah, right now I'm confused.
That's all for this program. If you found it interesting, there are four previous series available for download. Will the Atlantic Ocean circulation collapse this century? Is the government looking for an easy out on farming emissions? Has climate change made the jet stream go wobbly? All available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.